Well, change is constant, and the tricky part is knowing it when you see it. Craig Modd is a writer, photographer, and walker, who says that walking is an invitation to slow down and notice how we are always becoming something new, just like places and objects and relationships. Craig has walked thousands of kilometres around the world and in his chosen home in Japan, and he takes us along for a journey across an ancient pilgrimage route in rural Japan where young people are leaving in droves, through conversations with fishermen, innkeepers and cafe owners. He explores memory, identity, and how walking can quietly reshape how we understand who we are. His book is called Things Become Other Things, a walking memoir, and Craig Modd joins me now. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing?
Really good, thank you. So looking forward to this conversation. And you call the book a memoir. Is it a memoir about Craig Modd, or is it a memoir about walking as a force for good? What sort of memoir is it?
Yeah, both for sure. It's I'm sort of reluctant to write about myself too much, but because this is coming out with Random House, and we thought the audience was going to be bigger than my usual people that I'm writing for, who sort of know me and my work. We added quite a bit of sort of autobiographical elements to this book, including just how I ended up in Japan. I came when I was 19. And what that experience was like arriving in Tokyo at 19 and just feeling, even back then, the vast difference between life on the ground in a country like Japan versus where I came from in the States. And so there's a lot of that in there too, but then also a lot of my walking philosophy, why I walk and how I think about walking. And so, yeah, it is a little bit of a walking memoir as well.
Yeah, great. And how did you start doing serious walking?
Started doing big walks about 12 years ago. A good friend, Australian, who has lived out in Japan since he was about 16, 17, John McBride is his name. He spent his college years doing huge walks and doing research and thinking about Japanese literature. And then he kind of stopped for 30 years. And when he started up again, we had connected because I had written a book about the art world in Tokyo, and John was sort of connected with the art world in Australia and Japan. And he said, hey, look, I'm going to go on this UNESCO World Heritage pilgrimage walk. It's called the Kumano Kodo. Do you want to join me? I'm going to be doing some research, looking at, mapping out these new routes. And I had just gotten back from my stint in Palo Alto, and I was looking for what my next thing was going to be. And I said, yeah, let's do it. And honestly, from the first day of doing that, I was just mesmerized. We were walking the Kii Peninsula, which is the peninsula south of Kyoto and Osaka. And these are pilgrimage routes that have been in use for 2,000 years plus. And there was something just striking about walking from village to village, talking with these people who've lived in the area for generations, touching the history of the place in what remains, and there's stone markers on the road that were the markers used 400, 500, 600 years ago to guide pilgrims to go to the right for this temple or shrine and to the left for this one. And watching John kind of engage with it all, and then the physicality of it, of the climbing and the big days and carrying your pack, there's just something about holistically the whole experience that really, really captured my imagination.
You talk about something called the John effect. What was that?
So I was watching John. John and I had been friends for about 8 years at this point when we set off on this walk. And I knew John was a special guy, but seeing him out in the field, and John is totally not just fluent in Japanese. He's been doing tea ceremony for 40 years. And in tea ceremony, I think a lot of people misunderstand the depths of tea ceremony. Mm. It's not just a 5 or 10 minute activity where you kind of fold a couple napkins and pour some hot water into a bowl and whisk it and then hand it over to someone. A full tea ceremony is like 6-7 hours. And it involves cooking entire meals, and the language is very specific. So if you study tea ceremony for 40 years at a very high level, one of the things you come away with is almost like an imperial relationship to Japanese as a language. And watching John out in the field deploy aspects of tea ceremony language to farmers and watching those farmers completely just fall over backwards.
Gosh.
Because no one had ever spoken to them with that level of reverence. And then John's knowledge about the history of the path, asking questions about, you know, the local area, the local history, and watching everyone just switch from kind of suspicious of us, who are these two guys? Why are they here? What are they doing? To just completely in love with John and our ally, becoming an ally and wanting to do everything they could possibly do to help us have a great experience. And so that was, for me, that was profound to watch. And John and I have done in total over the last, you know, 13 years or so, probably 6 months of walking together. And so watching that happen for 6 months, you know, for hundreds of days, it's a pretty profound thing to witness. And you begin to believe in that as an archetype for how you can move throughout the world. So I nicknamed that the John effect.
Mm-hmm.
And as I walk a lot, you know, most of my walks are alone. As I walk alone, I try to embody and remember and deploy the John effect as much as I can.
Yeah, and to use your words, part of that John effect is your belief that through the power of respect, you can convert someone to your side.
Yeah, yeah. It's about meeting someone where they are on the road and having a kind of mutually elevating experience, conversation, and showing that respect. You know, it's funny, respect can be telegraphed really quickly through just knowledge of the area. So just showing that you've done a little bit of research, showing that you've put in a little bit of effort. And the language element, I mean, the fact that John speaks so well and has this kind of imperial tea ceremony tone is secondary to having done the work to study, to think about the path, to understand the history of the path. That's really what moves people. And also, you know, just even if someone is grumpy, even if someone looks like they don't want to help you, just kill them with kindness. Just be really, really, you know, kind of obnoxiously kind. And 9 out of 10 times,
yeah,
they flip and they just, you know, they want to give you free things. You know, a taxi driver that doesn't really want to take you by the end is giving you a free ride, is offering, you know, you essentially, you know, like to live at their house if you want. You know, it's like, it's pretty amazing to witness.
We're talking about the power of walking, among other things. Craig Mod is my guest, and his book is called Things Become Other Things, A Walking Memoir. I'm really interested in the power of walking to help you chew over an idea or an experience. And I wanted to talk about what's really the emotional core of the book, which is your reflections about a childhood friend who was tragically murdered right after you graduated high school in America, Brian. Does walking help to gain perspective on the event, but then also on the sort of profundity of the event in your life and identity?
Absolutely. And walking alone for me is really critical. I mean, all of these walks I've done with John have been just wonderful, and they are morning to night learning experiences, you know, and I'm just kind of basking in this archetype of goodness. And I think it was through that time with John that I was able to build up the confidence to do big walks on my own. You know, and I've done 30, 40 day walks alone. And being alone is critical to me because that's where the thinking happens. And I have, you know, I have rules for the walks where I'm not allowed to use social media. I'm not allowed to read the news, no podcasts, no music even while I'm walking. And the point is to kind of cultivate this extreme boredom. You know, kind of exist in a state these days with smartphones where if you have 3 seconds of boredom on the horizon, you're immediately reaching for the phone. You're immediately going to flick through a few things, check your notifications. So getting rid of that is critical. And then when you get rid of that, it turns out as you move your body and throughout history, you know, philosophers, physicists, many thinkers, you know, have relied on walking to kind of work through problems.
Well, it's innately human, isn't it? Humans have been walking for many more hundreds of thousands of years than we've been listening to podcasts.
For sure. And I think there's a physiological sort of reward that our
Yeah.
bodies give us for walking. And because walking was an evolutionary advantage to kind of get to move to a different area, to get to a better place, to find maybe an area with better resources, things like that. And so when you walk, your body's happy and it's sort of feeding you good chemicals. And for me, my mind just moves. It just starts moving and writing. And when I did this big walk for the book, Things Become Other Things, it was during the height of COVID, 2021. And so there was a kind of profound silence to the world, as I was in the middle of this huge walk on the peninsula. And, when you're 17 and your best friend from elementary school is murdered, you don't really have the tools to process that. You just don't. 17 is really young. And I think I know I had wanted to process it. And I tried to write about Brian before. Actually, the first short story I ever had published when I was 18 was a short story about us, based on parts of our childhood. And I spent years after that trying to write, but not knowing how to write about Brian. And it was, there's something about the kind of ensorcelment, the magic of COVID silencing the world and me going on this walk alone on this peninsula that has kind of almost like a socioeconomic rhyming with where Brian and I grew up. So very blue collar, very salt of the earth people. And I just started reflecting on like, why is this place that socioeconomically kind of feels like where we were from, why is it so devoid of the violence that we grew up kind of embedded in? And I don't think I would have ever given myself, been brave enough to give myself the time or permission to think about these things, were it not for the walk. And that's kind of the magic of doing these solo walks, is it unlocks your ability to make these connections and kind of sit with and reflect on these kind of historical and personal moments.
Is it a spiritual experience?
Oh, for sure. I mean, the way I describe it is, I don't know of a fuller day than one of these days that I'm fully giving to the walk. And my days on a walk are basically, I'll walk 30, 40, sometimes 50K in one day with a pack. And I do it over and over and over and over and over again. You do it for weeks, months. And I'll walk for 8 hours. I get to my inn, I'll get to my hotel, wherever it might be. I don't camp because I have a very specific set of things I want to do each night. And I kind of need a hotel room to do this. So I get to the place I'm going to, and then I spend the next 4 or 5 hours synthesizing what I experienced that day. So I'm dictating notes the whole time as I'm walking, and I'm talking to people. I have rules where I have to photograph someone before 10 a.m. in the morning, and I have to say hello to everyone I see on the road or farmers in their fields. I'm yelling hello to them. And so invariably I talk to a bunch of people, and invariably their stories are interesting, and they're just magical moments every single day, of snippets of conversation that then set my mind off thinking about this topic or that topic. And I'm dictating notes, and then I get to the hotel at night, and I've taken photos. I'm doing portraits all day, and I'll start importing those photos for the digital photos. I'm shooting a lot on film now, so those kind of come later. And so I'll look at the photos and I'll look at the notes and I'll start writing, and I'll write 2, 3, 4,000 words
Gosh.
every night. And
Sounds
you do
monastic,
that.
Craig.
It is fantastic. And I shave my head, and I kind of look like a monk, and I'm a fake monk. And it is monastic, but you use your body up all day, and you have all of these human connections, and it's incredible. And then at night, you spend 4 or 5 hours sort of synthesizing, and you finish with, I finish every day with an essay mixed with photos. So, and then that goes out to usually a newsletter. I publish what are called pop-up newsletters for the duration of these walks. So there's an audience on the other side, and I'm not writing for the audience, but I use the audience as the catalyst to do the writing. Because I know people are waiting on the other end. And so that gets me to do a little more work than I might do on my own. And I get into bed at the end of the day, and I am just zero. There's nothing left in me.
Yeah.
You know, it's there's the body is used, the mind is used. And I just think, man, whatever cards I was dealt that morning, we played the best hand possible for that day. And you do that over and over, and you feel that over and over again. And it does, it becomes almost like theological. It becomes this belief that every single day has a richness that is almost unbelievable otherwise, unless you've experienced it over and over and over, hundreds or thousands of times. And carrying that archetype of fullness back to the life outside of the walk has been one of the greatest gifts of doing these walks. And so carrying it back to family and friends and, you know, just daily sort of mundane life in the city or wherever you might be. But knowing that even in the most boring, mundane days, there's a richness to be kind of wrought out of the day. If you lean into engaging with it, it's there. And believing it's there every day has been an incredible gift to get.
Yeah, I'd worry I had nothing to write about that because I've traveled alone, and often in your head you're meeting interesting people and having adventures, but then actually when you get there you're by yourself and you're a bloke, and so people aren't naturally inclined to make conversation with you, and you can reach the end of the day and feel like, oh, I haven't really talked to anyone. So, but that's obviously not a problem for you. You have enough experiences and thoughts and, I suppose, revelations that you actually have something to say at the end of a day, which is essentially, in your words, just you with a bobbing consciousness.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's the people. You know, it's really the conversations that set...
You lean into those conversations, eh?
Yeah. And on the peninsula especially, you know, everyone has such an accent that I have a little bit of a connection to North Carolina in the States. And it has a really special place in my heart. And the language and the rhythms of language in North Carolina and the people and how they speak and the idioms are really just magical. I mean, Southern American dialects and turns of phrase are absolutely bar none one of the greatest sort of gifts of the American, or, you know, the, I think the English language in general. And so when I'm in the peninsula, especially when I'm in these Southern remote parts of Japan, I feel sort of a kinship with North Carolinian English in the Japanese. And so that too is just such a wonderful gift to experience. And yeah, just the things people say and the way they say them, and how it's almost more exaggerated because Japanese is usually so formal. And you realize Tokyo, the Japanese in Tokyo is really like, it's almost like BBC English. It's like the most boring, you know, sort of the laced up version of Japanese. And when you get into the countryside and you feel it, the shoulders relax and kind of the language get broken down a little bit, there's a real joy in that. And so I find so much inspiration just talking to these people and being able to pull these conversations out, and then from that dialogue, you know, all sorts of other thoughts just kind of naturally flow. So it's really the people that are the catalyst for most of the writing.
Can you tell us about the cafe owner and his toilet?
the cafe owner and the toilet. Which can you give me another hint?
Yeah,
there's been a few cafe owners and toilets.
There was a guy who created a toilet specifically to dazzle his customers.
Oh yeah, that was on a big walk. It was towards the end of it. I walked from Tokyo to Kyoto. I've done that 3 times now, and I was walking along the Nakasendo, which is one of the old routes. And on the last, this would have been the last day of the walk. So I was walking from Kusatsu into Kyoto itself. And I stopped for lunch at this weird little cafe, just picked randomly. And I do very little planning with the cafes. I just kind of pop into whatever appears along the road. And this guy, you know, he was very formal and he was wearing a pork pie hat and kind of had almost like a bartender's uniform with, I don't know what they're called, like the arm garters. Do you know what I'm talking about? Those kind of, you know, old-timey bartenders wear them with like almost like the bands around their biceps to hold their,
I'm gonna have to look
hold
it
their
up.
Sleeves up. Yeah, it sort of looks like a garter belt you put on your arm. And, you know, there's no other customers. And this was in the middle of sort of nowhere. And you're just kind of like, what is this place? And it was sort of a listening bar, restaurant, cafe. It had been around for 40 years. records all over the back wall, big speakers, a grand piano in the corner. Very bizarre. And we had talked and talked and talked, and he was asking me, what did I like about Japan? And I said a couple of ridiculous things, like I think my answer was healthcare and no guns. That was what I loved about Japan. He's like, oh, that's interesting. I'll have to think about that. And then he goes, before you leave, I must ask you to use the toilet. I was like, oh God, it was almost like a serial killer moment. Like, is he going to chop me up in this toilet? And I go in, and anyway, the cafe was pretty dark and woody. And I go into this toilet, and you open the door, and it was like this light from some sort of ethereal heaven, like the like almost the light of Zeus was coming down from this skylight that was, 3 meters high. Suddenly the ceiling is up 3 meters. It was like this alternate universe, and the whole room was just bathed in light, and the toilet was sort of in the middle, and it just looked holy and imperial. It was just so bizarre. And this huge mirror, it was almost like like you thought David Bowie was going to pop out and like do a dance, a dance from Labyrinth or something in like in a full body, tight suit. And anyway, it was just very funny. And then he put on, I think he put on like Here Comes the Sun or something. Like he added a musical component to it in the cafe. And it was just very surreal and funny, and it was amazing how much pride he had in this sort of clearly architected to be very impressive and a little bit scary in some ways toilet.
There's so much more I wanted to talk to you about. We're almost out of time. Two things, though. Pizza toast. What is pizza toast?
Pizza toast is something you think you could make at home, and you can. And the Japanese post-war, it was a very resource-constrained country post-war, extremely impoverished, kind of across the board. And in that time, these Japanese-style cafes called kisaten kind of appeared, and it's sort of the equivalent of American diners, Japanese version of American diners. And they serve coffee, and they didn't have many big kitchens, and so they're sort of hacked their way around, like, well, what kind of food can we serve to customers? And toast happened to be this thing that was just starting to really rev up post-war in Japan, really getting into toast. And so toast was always on the menu. And then they thought, well, how can we take this one easy step further? And so they started making pizza toast, which is really just thick cut toast, like really thick cut, like 5 centimeter thick toast. And on top of that, the simplest tomato sauce you can imagine, almost it barely one step above ketchup, essentially, and then maybe some sliced bell peppers, maybe a little bit of onion, and then sliced cheese, so like almost like American cheese on top of it. Put it in a toaster oven, and out it comes. And so this is a staple that you can find almost everywhere in the country. This is one of the weird things about these kisaten, these Japanese cafes, is there's no governing body that set the menu for these things. It was almost like this organic, sort of mimetic spread of culinary, sort of foundational elements. So pizza toast is sort of everywhere. There's a little variation. Certain locales do different things with the toast. In the Kansai region, they put anko, which is sort of a red bean paste on the toast. In the Tokyo area, they don't do that. But pizza toast is weirdly prevalent. And if you are traveling to Japan, you may think, oh, I need to eat sushi. I should get tempura. I should get udon. But you should also look for an old kisaten and have yourself a little pizza toast meal. It's a weird kind of Japan-only culinary experiment slash foundational food element here, and most people never experience it. And so as I was doing one of these big walks, I realized by chance every day I was eating pizza toast. So that became a big theme of one of my books.
Well, the book is called Things Become Other Things, a walking memoir. And final question, where did that title come from?
It actually came from a conversation. Again, the language of the people of the peninsula, to me is really powerful. I mean, I'm just I love language, and I love language deployed in certain ways with kind of a looseness that you find in Southern American English and in the Japanese of this peninsula. And I'd stayed at this bed and breakfast with essentially a husband and wife who were in their 70s. And this daughter appeared the next morning while I was having breakfast. And she just kind of walked in. She was maybe 30. And she said, "Hi, I'm the daughter." And they said, "Oh, this is our daughter." You know, and I was like, "Oh, hello." And I was, but I had to get walking. I had a big day. And so the husband was driving me back to the trailhead. And in the car, he said, "Actually, that's not our daughter." I said, oh, really? I was like, who was that? It's a very weird thing to suddenly say. It's like, oh, this is, you know, again, you know, this kind of like serial killer kidnapping situation. Like, what's going on here? And he goes, "No, it's not our daughter." He's like, "She just appeared on our doorstep one day, 5 or 6 years ago. And we gave her a job and we kind of took her in. And over, you know, the next couple of years, it changed from this random woman who had, young woman who appeared and needed help to what we consider a daughter now." And he goes, "You know, time passes and things become other things." And I thought, yeah, they do become other things.
Beautiful work.
Yeah.
Gosh, I've loved our conversation and I could go for hours. Thank you very much. Thank you so much for taking some time for us and for the thoughts and love that you're putting into this project. And we'll send people to the book and also to your newsletters, which are often the best way of finding out what you're up to on the road. Craig Mod, thank you.
Thank you, Jesse. It's been a pleasure.